Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to this new series of Bookmark. We hope you've had a good summer catching up on all your reading, and we're starting with a cracker of a show for you. Our featured guest is Annie Domingo, talking about her debut novel Breaking the Maffa Chain. We'll also hear from Hayley Hughes talking about Humans in the Classroom, testimonies from teachers around the world, and Trudy Tate from Literature Cambridge chats about the upcoming programme of events. First of all, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Annie, but welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Good. Oh, it's lovely to have you. And we're going to be talking a lot about Breaking the Maffa Chain, but I just wanted to have a little chat with you about your other role in life. Well, you've got many roles in life, but one of your other roles in life, acting. You're an actress. People might know you from Doctors, EastEnders, stage work too. Did that help, being an actress, when it came to writing?
Yes, I think it did, especially for the dialogue. I can hear them and I could picture it. So, yes, it certainly gave me ways of getting into the different characters. I could differentiate their voices, which is one of the difficult things when you're writing, to hear the different voices, the different cadence. As an actress, I could do that. At least I think I have.
Yes, I think you have as well. And you live in Cambridge now, but you were born in Sierra Leone.
No, I wasn't. No? I was born in London.
Moved
but
to
my,
Sierra
yes,
Leone?
My parents were from Sierra Leone and they were here from the start of the war. And then after I was born, I have an older sister and I have a younger brother who was always also born here. When my older sister told my mother that she wasn't black, she was English, they felt it was about time they took us home for us to know where we came from. So we went back to Sierra Leone. My parents felt that we needed to have a grounding in our own culture and that. And so I did all my education there and then came over to go to college. So my secondary school and all of that was done in Sierra Leone.
And did it work? Did your parents' ideas work? Did you feel grounded in?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's one of the reasons why I've been able to get into the story for Breaking the Maffa. I could look and I could think and I could remember about the African villages. Although I did not live in a village, we visited it sometimes. When I read something about it, I can envisage it, I can feel it. Whilst I was writing, I did go back to Sierra Leone and I went to the Gambia and also to South Carolina just to get the feel and the sound and so on. Even though we're in England, and even though I'm in England now, I eat a lot of African food. I hear the music and so on. So that certainly grounded me.
And you were in recently, well, before chaos struck, really, you were in the Nigerian version of Three Sisters at National Theatre,
yeah,
which was notable for having an all-black cast and for focusing on a different kind of experience.
Yes, it was a great adaptation because Inua Ellums, who's a fantastic writer and a poet, was able to use the things that were happening in Russia at the time and see the parallels of what was happening during the Biafran War. It was an absolute honour to be in that.
An all-black cast, do you think post-Black Lives Matter, I don't know whether we're post it or ever will be, but do you think there's more opportunities for black actors now?
Yes, that has been growing. But at the moment, there are so many shows with all black cast or some black cast in it. And I don't think it's just Black Lives Matter. It's also to do with George Floyd. It's also to do with the pandemic. It's also the fact that people started thinking about what they wanted and what they wanted to hear and what they wanted to see. One of the things from coming back to the theatre after the pandemic is that they've been doing a lot of one person, two people, three people shows, tight black shows that I've been to, but that's now expanding. So tomorrow I'm going to the National to see Rockets and Blue Lights by Winsome Pinnock. And that has a cast of about 10, not all black, but it's about what happened to a black girl in London after the slave trade. That's very much in the area that I'm interested in at the moment. And I did one of Winsome's play, one of her first plays in the 80s. She's been a great friend since then. So I'm looking forward to seeing this, having two things. And I've got a couple of friends in it.
Let's move from theatre to music now. We're going to hear your first choice of music in just a moment. But is music important to you, Annie?
music is extremely important to me. My parents, during the war, were semi-professional ballroom dancers in England, and they used to go off and do demonstration dances in places like the Waldorf and so on. So I've always had music. My mother was a fantastic singer, although she was never professional. She wanted to be a professional actress. She was also an actress. But her parents, just before the war, would not allow it. But she did a lot of amateur plays as well as singing, and she won awards. So I always had music around the house. I'm a singer. My first West End show was the musical version of Gone with the Wind. And I've done lots of pantomimes and things and musical shows. So, yes, music and dance is very much part of the whole package.
And what about this one then? This is What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong.
Louis Armstrong was a favorite with my parents, all the jazz, the Ella Fitzgeralds and Louis Armstrong. But for me, Louis Armstrong was quite special, because he did a tour of West Africa in the 60s and came to Sierra Leone. My mother was one of the MCs for the show. And so we went to see it, and I'd heard his music all the time, for always, all my life. But after the show, we went backstage and I had a chat with Louis Armstrong.
Wow.
And I was only about six, and I sat on his lap and he gave me some of his Coca-Cola. So,
wow.
So, yes, and I used to do an imitation of Louis Armstrong to amuse my siblings, and that What a Wonderful World was one of the ones I used to sing for my siblings and for my parents and for anybody who would listen, really. So it's a favorite of mine.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying how do you do. They're really saying I love you. I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. They learn much more than I never knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That was What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong, the first choice of music from our featured guest on Bookmark today, Annie Domingo. Annie is an actress, as we've heard, a lecturer, director and graduate of the Anglian Ruskin Creative Writing MA. Breaking the Maffa Chain, her debut novel, was shortlisted for the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize and won Myriad Edition's First Novel Award. Aminata Fauna called it richly imagined and compellingly told. Breaking the Maffa Chain, she said, is a gift to readers everywhere. I enjoyed it very much, I must say. And we're going to talk about it, obviously, in depth, but Annie, the Maffa Chain. Perhaps you can tell us, first of all, what is the Maffa Chain?
Maffa is a Swahili word that means African Holocaust, and that was to do with the slave trade. So for me, I saw Sarah breaking that chain. She broke the mold of that chain, of that transatlantic slave trade. She showed that there was a different way.
And for people who haven't read the novel, and it is only just out, what is it about? Who is Sarah?
Sarah was a young girl in an African village, raided by the king of Dahomey, who was the kingpin of slave trade. And he had these amazing warriors who were women, who were called the Amazon warriors. And they raided this village and they captured a lot of people. We don't know very much about Sarah. Sarah is not fiction. She was a real life person. But her earliest story isn't known because the village was wiped out. They do know that she had siblings. And from the markings on her face, they knew that she was the daughter of a chief or a king. She was sold several times and she ended up in the King of Dahomey's palace with the slaves. At the same time, Queen Victoria had the patrol of the Royal Navy going up and down West African coast to stop the illegal slave trade that was still going on. And if they captured any of the ships and the people in it, they would deposit them in Freetown in Sierra Leone, instead of them going back to whether they came from Nigeria or Angola or that. They went to Sierra Leone. But he was in Dahomey trying to persuade the king to stop the slave trade. And they were about to sacrifice this girl. She was about to be killed. And Captain Forbes objected and threatened the king that he would not be held in favor with Queen Victoria, who the king was trying to have friendly relationships with England. And to embarrass the captain and to embarrass Queen Victoria, he said, okay, I won't kill her, but you can take her as a present to Queen Victoria, from the king of the blacks to the queen of the whites. And Captain Forbes was in a quandary. If he didn't take her, the child would be killed. But how can he accept a slave? So anyway, he did accept her because he didn't want to be killed. And she was brought to England and she met Queen Victoria, which they didn't think she'd meet. And Queen Victoria really got close to Sarah. She was christened Sarah and Forbes after Captain Forbes and Bonetta after the ship that brought her to England.
So it's based on a true story. I know you've added things into it.
Yes, I did a lot of research on her and Queen Victoria and so on. But I wanted to tell her story of what her life was like before she became a slave, before she came to England, to understand where her mind was, what she was seeing and the comparisons. Because when she was captured, she was only about 4 or 5. And when she came to England, she was about 8. So she was still very impressionable and trying to just make sense of everything. And I know that although I was born in England, I remember coming back to go to college and sort of thinking some of these people are so strange, the things they did, the way they did it. So I just used some of that to get into Sarah's mind.
And how much license did you give yourself for wriggle room there, given that it's a true story?
I gave myself some license because, for example, she's mentioned several times in Queen Victoria's diaries. But if you read any of Queen Victoria's biographies, she's never mentioned. And that was the first thing that intrigued me. And so I spent a lot of time reading through Queen Victoria's diaries, not just about the time that she mentioned Sarah, but the things that were happening around that time. And the first thing was that Queen Victoria met her on the 11th of November. She mentions it in her diary. And then early January, she mentioned Sarah again and says, this is the fourth time I've seen my black godchild. And I thought, whoa, from in November with Christmas in the middle and into January, she's seen this child 4 times. And that was what sparked off what was that relationship between them. And then also the relationship between Sarah and the princesses. She was very close to Princess Alice. When you read the diaries, Queen Victoria supported Sarah. She paid for all her schooling. She paid for her clothing. But she didn't live with Queen Victoria. She visited Queen Victoria in the Windsor Palace because Captain Forbes, her home was in Windsor. But she was also invited to Osborne House. She was also invited to Buckingham Palace. She was especially invited to Princess Victoria's wedding, to Princess Alice's wedding. So there was a strong relationship. I wasn't there when she was talking to Queen Victoria. I have to make surmises for what was happening, what that relationship or that conversation would have been about.
What do you make of Queen Victoria? I mean, it's quite something, A, to write her, but what do you make of her motivations? Were they kind with her generally? Because she would have controlled Sarah as well. She wasn't free.
That's part of the dichotomy. She was written about a lot in the newspapers. She was called the Black Princess or the African Princess, and they would journey what she was doing. But she had no freedom, partly because she was a girl, a child. And when you think about it, in Victorian times, even though there was a queen, women did not have as much liberty as they do now. And that was part of the things that I wanted to look at, because her fictional sister was a slave and did go to America. And I wanted to look at what was happening between a slave and a princess. And though her sister was renamed Faith, was a slave, she had far more freedom than Sarah, who was called a princess. And that was part of the things that I wanted to look at.
There's lots of dichotomies in the book. You've got Faith and Sarah, freedom and captivity. Even within Sarah as well, there's a dichotomy. She has split personalities going too far, but she hears her original voice, if you like.
That was one of the things that I wanted to know, that especially with children, they can adapt, or they can seem to adapt. But what is going on? Because I know when I went back to Africa at about 4, I was a little bit like that. I had two voices in my head. This new place that was exciting and that, but very strange. And the longing for what I had left behind. I was about the same age as Sarah was, and wanting to know. And so no, I've got to be here. This is where I am. Stop it. Don't talk to me. And I wanted to show that her internal journey by having that other voice that sort of pulled her up and sometimes was quite frightening to her and sometimes quite comforting.
It must have been so confusing for her. The Victorian class system is confusing for people at the best of times. But as you say, a black girl, not really born into any class, brought into a class, not belonging to a family, but sort of belonging to a family. Yeah. Where did she place herself? What did she want to be? What were her aspirations?
This is it. I mean, breaking the Mafra chain goes up to when she's sent back to Africa after 1 year, not necessarily to the same place, but the same continent where she had just come away from, where she was captured as a slave. And that as well must have been very confusing for her. She wanted to go back. She wanted to find her sister. But was the king there waiting for her? But she did come back. Queen Victoria sent back, called for her to come back. She was sent to Sierra Leone, where I'm from, and she went to school there. And that was a whole different thing, which is not in this book, it's in the next one that I'm already writing. But I just wanted to show the journey that a child has to go through. Nobody really explains to her. All of a sudden, they say, oh, you're going to be christened. Somebody says, oh, because you're going to be saved. And she's like, well, why do I have to come all the way to England to be saved? Why couldn't Jesus have saved me in Africa so I didn't go through all of this? Which to me seems quite a reasonable argument. But it's sort of looking at the innocence of children and how they can put some questions that you don't have any answers for, because they look at it from a completely different point of view. It's quite clear and innocent.
Do you think there are things that we can learn for today? Are there parallels with today's experiences, perhaps with refugees, for example?
Yes, I think that we sometimes forget that when we're busy saving people or helping them, that there's another life that they have that sometimes they can't even talk about because they're so busy trying to be assimilated into the new life and to be accepted, so that what has gone past is sort of almost not allowed to be spoken about. You find that a lot of children of immigrants don't speak their original language, their parents' language, because the parents don't want them to be confused. They want them to, now you're in England or America or Germany or wherever, this is where you belong. But in fact, mentally, it's not good for their health sometimes. And this is what was happening with Sarah. Mentally, she was a very confused girl, and she felt that she had to almost cut off a part of herself to be accepted.
Thank you, Annie. We'll come back to you in just a moment, but we mentioned refugees there. Actually, that's one of the subjects that I discussed with Trudy Tate from Literature Cambridge. Literature Cambridge is an independent educational organisation providing top quality courses on the best of literature in English. I spoke to Trudy, its founder, about their upcoming season. But first, I asked her to tell me a little more about Literature Cambridge.
Literature Cambridge has been going for about 6 years, and we started originally doing summer schools on Virginia Woolf, which is our great passion. And then we added some more summer schools. So we'd do a week on Virginia Woolf, and then we'd do a week on other literature. So we've been doing that really up until lockdowns came and stopped us from meeting in person. And we also were doing study days at Stapleford Granary, where we'd have a whole day on a Shakespeare play or a Woolf novel. Since lockdown, we've moved everything online and we've changed how we do things, and it's been incredibly exciting and far exceeded my expectations as to what you can actually do on Zoom. Most weeks we'll have one and sometimes more than one session. Most of them are freestanding sessions, and they'll be on one book or one Shakespeare play. And so you can join us to study, say, Virginia Woolf's The Waves, and there'll be a lecture and a seminar. And to our delight and surprise, people are joining us from New York and Brazil, Japan, France, Sweden. And lots of people come to many, many of the sessions, and they're getting to know each other. People raise the most interesting questions, and they get into conversations with each other. It's just amazing.
How great that something that you thought initially was not going to work for you has actually brought in people from all around the world who share an interest in a particular book or author.
Absolutely. And of course, lots of the people who join us are from Cambridge because they knew us before. And, you know, I'll see sort of my neighbours joining us or people down the road alongside somebody from Argentina or whatever. I was extremely sceptical. I really didn't think it would work, but it's just been amazing. So when we can resume in-person events, we will, but we'll keep the online ones because I think it serves different audiences.
So what events have you got coming up?
October is really exciting. Things are really getting moving. Some of the sessions from the Women Writers Seasons will continue. So, for example, we've got a session on Radcliffe Hall, The Well of Loneliness, with Alison Hennigan, who's a world expert on Radcliffe Hall. We've got our Virginia Woolf season running, our second Virginia Woolf season this is, where we study almost all of Woolf's novels with different lecturers, different themes and so forth. So we've got sessions on Orlando, on Shakespeare in a Room of One's Own. That's going to be amazing. So we've got the Woolf season happening. We've also got a session, a step one-off session on George Eliot Middlemarch. Plus we've got the beginning of our History of the Sonnet season. That starts at the very beginning of October, on the 1st of October, and it runs every week, 6 weeks on the history of the sonnet, starting with the earliest sonnets right up to the present day, with Mariah Whelan, who's this absolutely wonderful poet and teacher, lecturer. After the history of the sonnet, we take a breath for 1 week, and then we've got a 2-week sonnet workshop where people actually can work on writing sonnets. They don't have to come to the previous course. They can just come to the sonnet workshop fresh, or they may wish to continue. It's fine. That's our first workshop that we've done in these online seasons.
So you're very, very busy. How accessible are these sessions? Because people might think, I don't know, they might be put off by the fact that Cambridge is in the title. They might think these are just for scholars. How accessible are they?
Oh, they're very accessible. They're aimed at what Virginia Woolf called the common reader, which is not meant to be an insult at all. It's a non-professional, intelligent reader who just loves literature. We get all sorts of people joining us. Some of them are students, some of them are even scholars, but most are not. Lots of the sessions are introductory. Some of them are a little more advanced than that, but really accessible. So, for example, we've got a session on colour into the lighthouse with an art historian, Claudia Tobin. She comes with a wealth of knowledge of art history, but she does it in a very accessible way. So you absolutely don't need to be an expert. Obviously, people will get much, much more out of it if they have read the book and just come and listen and learn. We've got retired doctors. We've got people that work with refugees, all sorts of people from all dentists, you name it, all walks of life who just either love literature and want to learn more about it, or maybe they haven't worked much with literature, but they think now they'd like to start. So don't feel shy. Come along. We've got D.H. Lawrence, Lady Chatterley's lover. That's for everyone.
And how do you choose what writers and what subjects to focus on?
It's partly the passions of the people that teach for us. I feel it's fantastic for people to teach the things they love. And I know there's a huge audience out there, particularly for Woolf, but also there's a huge audience for Shakespeare. I choose things that we love and that we think people will be interested in. Also, we occasionally just ask people, what would you like to study? And so somebody said Iris Murdoch. So that was a great suggestion. Occasionally we do surveys. I did one in March and about 200 people replied with the sorts of things that they wanted to study. And one thing that lots of people said was Victorian literature, which we love. And you sort of think, oh, do people want to read Dickens? Yes, people do want to read Dickens. A lot of this stuff is taught less in universities than it used to be. Not every university will teach Dickens or George Eliot or Iris Murdoch. Yeah, we're offering things that we think are worthwhile and that maybe people ask for. And also, I just come across fantastic teachers and think, I would love to use this teacher. What can you teach? So we've got a lovely young teacher who's going to be teaching Bernardine Evaristo's Girl, Woman, Other, you know, which won the Booker Prize a couple of years ago. It's a wonderful book. And this lecturer, Joseph Steinberg, is very interested in the history of the Booker Prize and how this book, which is so radical and challenging, and then it wins this prize, a conventional prize. Well, not necessarily, because Ishiguro and all sorts of incredible writers have won it. So it's not necessarily a conventional thing to win. Even so, Winning a prize raises all sorts of questions, which this book is very interested in. So some of the lectures are chosen partly by who my lecturers are, although in fact I did want to teach the Evaristo anyway, because I think it's really interesting.
So with somebody like Bernardine Evaristo, you're coming up to the present day.
That's right. I mean, we have a special interest in the early 20th century Victorians and Shakespeare, but I have a great interest in contemporary writing, and many of my lecturers do as well, and we know our audience does. I think at some point we'll do a season on contemporary writing, but at the moment we're just doing one-off sessions on contemporary writers here and there. There's loads of other contemporary writers I would love to teach. Ishiguro is another one. Also, we're very interested in refugee writers, so once a year on at the moment on Boxing Day, we do a session on refugee writings. So last year, we looked at some Vietnamese refugee writers, and also we looked at refugee tales, some of those volumes, which are fantastic. They're British-based. Some are written by detainees, and some are narrated by detainees to existing writers such as Ali Smith and others. And they're absolutely heartbreaking. These are people, refugees, who've fled their home countries. They've often had the most appalling experiences. Come to this country and they're put into detention, often for years, because at the moment there's indefinite detention. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And so there are various charities that support these detainees, listening to their stories and publishing them in these books, Refugee Tales. So the fourth Refugee Tales has just come out recently, and we're going to study that this Boxing Day, alongside another Vietnamese refugee writer called Thuy Le. She wrote this absolutely wonderful novel called The Gangster We Are All Looking For, about a Vietnamese family who end up in America, and how difficult it is to settle and to revisit the past and know who you are and so on. It's just completely wonderful. And the refugee session is always a charity session, and all the money that comes in goes to refugee charities. And I hope we can do more charity work as we develop.
And I can hear in your voice how enthusiastic you are for literature. When did that start, Trudy? When did you first fall in love with writing?
I think probably when I was at school and I was reading Jane Eyre under the desk in the maths lesson. And then also, yes, I sometimes used to bunk off school and go and sit in a cafe, and I used to read Solzhenitsyn, who was very big. This is in the early 70s and very interesting. So, yes, I think I've had a lifelong love of literature. Before I went to university, I took a few years out and I was working as a barmaid in the countryside in West Australia. So I'd be working as a barmaid and I didn't have a television. And so I just used to read all the time, and I used to buy the fantastic secondhand bookshops in these country towns. So I just read everything. So eventually when I did go to university, I was extremely well because of my idle and misspent youth. And it's never really changed since then.
And you can find out more about Literature Cambridge on their website, literaturecambridge.co.uk. We're talking on Bookmark today to Annie Domingo about her debut novel, Breaking the Maffa Chain. Annie, we talked about a little bit about the psychology there of Sarah splitting herself in two. Was that something that you researched and looked into?
I did a little bit about that. We're not very clear about how children, especially, how they assimilate facts and how they remember things. And sometimes it's very confusing for them to make sense of it. We say things that we think they just accept or they understand, but they don't. And we don't give them the room sometimes to ask. I watched a program once about children who were... The parents were talking about their children know not to go away with strangers. And so they did a test. Parents would say, just wait here. I'm just going across the way there. Sit down, have your ice cream. And then somebody came and said, oh, Sally or Jane or whatever, your mom says to come. And every single child went. And when the parents asked them, they said, well, they're not strangers. They knew my name. So it's finding out what it is, the way that a child thinks, to understand what could be traumatic to them.
And what about racism? This is 1850s London. Where did you research what was going on there for black people during that time?
I did a lot of research, a lot of reading and talking to people, thinking about some of things that have happened in my life, thinking about some of the things that happened to my parents when they came to London. My mother came in 1941 on a convoy boat during the war. And I remember some of the things that she said. You literally had signs saying, no Irish, no dogs, no blacks. And how difficult it was to find places. But for me, I know there were lots of black people in England even before that. There was a school in Clapham in 1785 for black boys from Sierra Leone, Nova Scotia, and that, a boarding school, started by people like William Wilberforce and Thomas Clarkson. There were lots of children, boys, especially from different parts of Africa and India, who were sent to England to go to school and then go back and work in their countries, but also so that they would acquire some of the knowledge of England, or sometimes to France or to Holland, so that they could be mediators, so that they could be the traders who could speak the language and understand the white people. There were lots of black people who were born in England, even in the 1800s. So she, Sarah, for example, meets one of them who says, yeah, I don't want to go to Africa. You know, things are here. I wanted to look at the different levels of black people and what was racist about it or what was not. And it was at the time when you had the black and white minstrels, for example, and Sarah, she recognized something about the songs. But when she saw them taking the black off, she was absolutely petrified. Could black people take their blacks off and become white and become accepted? That's what she wanted to know. There were lots of little things like that that I sort of did some research about. I wanted to find out what the life was like in Victorian times for black people and for white people, rich and poor.
And how did it feel writing this as a black woman? Because the experiences that she has as a black person, as a woman, some of the language in there is quite hard to hear and to read. And how did it feel writing that?
The way I look at it is, if I'm going to be true to the period, then I have to use the language that was used there. And it is something that I talked about with my publisher. And I said, on reflection, I'm not going to change it because then I'm not being true. And I'm glad when people sort of recoil from it, because that shows that we have progressed some, a little bit. At least people are aware of it. But the thing about Sarah was that she was treated in some ways extremely well. But then there were other people who were not. And that was where it was good to have her sister be in the book. And when she comes to England and see how she was treated, because she didn't have the thing about the royal patronage, and what she saw, and even times when they were in the same place, they didn't recognize each other. But what they saw or how they interpreted it was completely different because of the premise of how they were there and what they were there for and so on. For me, I found that fascinating. The book is set at the time when they had quite a lot of escaped slaves coming to England, trying to get money to help other enslaved people to get their freedom. And that was a big thing. It was at the time when the abolitionists were really pushing. The slave trade had finished, but slavery hadn't finished. So there were all these dichotomies of things that were happening at the same time. So I found it fascinating. Sometimes I seem to enjoy the research more than sitting down and then writing it in the story, because I had to try to find those facts and then write about them without looking as just research, going into their minds and their hearts and see what was happening with the things that were in their lives around them.
Well, let's take a break for some music now. So this is your second choice. This is Billie Holiday, and He's Funny That Way. Why this one?
My father was a great jazz. My mother was a singer. I sang jazz and blues. We all loved Billie Holiday. He's Funny That Way was a song that was I sang in a musical that I did called One More Time. I loved the song. It said so many things. But one of the reasons why I chose that was that when I got married, we had the blessing in my garden. I said, well, if everybody's making speeches, I'm going to make a speech too, even if I'm the bride. But I didn't make a speech. I sang that song to my husband on our wedding day. So that's why.
I'm not much to look at, nothing to see, just glad I'm living and lucky to be. I've got a man crazy for me, he's funny that way. I can't save a dollar, ain't worth a cent. He doesn't holler, he'd live in a tent. I've got a man crazy for me, he's funny that way. loves to work and slave for me every day. He'd be so much better off if I went away. But why should I leave him? Why should I go? He'd be unhappy without me, I know. I've got that man mad about me. He's funny that way. I can see no other way, and no better plan. Let him go to some other gal. But I'm only human, a coward at best. I'm more than certain he'd follow me west. I've got a man for me. He's funny that way.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Rather than books.
And our featured guest on Bookmark today is Annie Domingo, talking about her debut novel, Breaking the Maffa Chain. Annie, we were talking earlier on about research. There's lots about myths and superstitions in the novel as well that Sarah has brought with her from her tribal background. How many of those are based on truth?
All the myths and things are based on truths, on myths that I know about, myths and feelings that I've researched. The thing about Mami Wata and the whole thing about disturbing the goddess of the sea and that she could grab people and bring them down is all over Africa and the West Indies, sometimes called a different name. So those are myths. When I was growing up, we were always told to be careful, though we lived on the coast and there was lots of water and everything. Very few of us really swam. We'd go on boats and things because there was always this fear that you were going to be grabbed and taken down by Mami Wata. So that sort of thing is, it's true. A lot of the research, sometimes, I don't know where it came from, it would come to me, maybe from childhood or something. And then when I research it, I would find that it was something that was there. And that happened again and again. The whole thing about the color blue, the importance of blue. And then I found out later on that they did do the things with hanging the bottles to capture the spirits. And I thought that was just in Africa. But when I was in South Carolina and in Florida, you'd see these bottle trees. Even if they were not trees, they'd make them out of wire in the shape of a tree with these bottles hanging from them. It came from the slaves that came from Africa and brought some of those traditions and things with them. And so some of the myths and things roll on. And for me, that was part of the fascination to see what is still here and what has been held on to. Sometimes changed, or the whole early knowledge of it is slightly skewed and so on. But it happened again and again that you find that there are some truths about it, especially when you start going into the history of different places. I spent a long time researching South Carolina because a lot of the people were taken from Sierra Leone to South Carolina because they knew how to grow rice. So from Gambia and around, they called it the Senegambia coast. and they were taken to South Carolina to grow rice. But the problem with slavery in America was that they would sell people and they would move around from different plantations. But in South Carolina, that did not happen so much because in those days there were islands. So you'd find that several generations had stayed in the same place and therefore they were able to carry on their traditions and use some of their words. And when I went to South Carolina, to Hamilton, they're now joined up with causeways and things. They're not islands anymore. In South Carolina, they speak the Gullah language. And for a long time, that was laughed at and looked down upon in America. But in fact, they're the only black people in America who have their own language because they stayed together. And when I went there, I could understand what they were saying because it was very similar to an old-fashioned version of my language. And when I spoke to them in my language, they could understand me. And this is several generations later. Certain words were exactly the same. To me, that was absolutely fascinating that through generations, through all the things that were happening, they were still holding on to something, which is where I got the fact that Fatmata held on to some of her words, her names, and some of those traditions. One of the most amazing things that always gets me is that there was a guy, Joseph Papp, from America, who worked in Sierra Leone, and then he went back to America, and he was very interested in the language, and he went to visit somebody down in South Carolina with somebody from Sierra Leone, and they were singing songs and that, and this man says, "That's my language." You know, it's an old-fashioned version. And later on, they were able to work out the exact village. They worked out who it was, and her name was Priscilla. In seven generations, they were able to work out exactly who she was because they hadn't moved around very much. And when they went to Sierra Leone, they were singing this song and they said, "Oh, this is a lullaby." And the woman says, "No, that song is a burial song."
Oh, wow.
And that always gets to me because yes, you just realize that although they've taken some things, some of it's changed. And I can just see that young woman singing to her baby of what she's lost and the baby goes to sleep and they think it's a lullaby.
So much material, Annie, in this research. You must have, I mean, as a writer, how do you then structure it? What do you do? I mean, it's a gift, but you must have kept hearing things and think, I want to include that, but I've only got so many words.
Yes, this is a big problem because I tend to overwrite and then I spend a long time editing down and going for the core of it. I don't want it to look like, here comes the research. But it has to merge in. So, for example, the thing about keeping songs and all of that tradition, one of the characters always singing a song. That's where the knowledge comes from. I didn't need to say this is what they always do and so on. So, and of course, I've got lots more of that material and research that is done that I haven't used. But some of that is going into the sequel of when Sarah has grown up and understands some more. So, yes, the thing about the Maffa chain started vaguely from the MA course. So it's been going on a long time. It's been gestating around for a long time, different versions.
The Anglia Ruskin University MA in Creative Writing you're talking about there links me nicely to my next guest, introducing her, because she's a teacher, Hayley Hughes. She's an English teacher and senior leader who has mentored new teachers and students for more than a decade. Humans in the Classroom, her book, came out earlier this year. And when I spoke to Hayley, I asked her to tell me what the book is about.
Humans in the Classroom is a compendium of amazing teacher stories from all around the world. So it talks about their backgrounds, their ideologies, what has led to them becoming teachers, really. So it's really interesting and quite inspiring book.
Why did you decide to do this?
Well, I've been a teacher for around 15 years and I live in the village that I taught in. And very often you get that reaction from students where they see you outside of school and in shock say, "Miss, I saw you in the supermarket." So I had this idea really that kids really sometimes don't see their teachers as human beings. And we are. We have our own kind of idiosyncrasies and characteristics just the same as anybody else. So I just thought it'd be really good, especially in the global pandemic when teachers have contributed so much to efforts of getting through the really bizarre situation we've been in for the last 18 months, to celebrate teachers really and the contribution that they make.
And how did you contact all these different teachers in all these different countries?
Well, I have quite a large Twitter following. There's a huge contingent of teachers that use Twitter. And I put out the initial idea for the book there and lots of people picked up on it. And I kind of picked case studies from people who contacted me from there.
So how many did you end up with in the end and from where?
I think I ended up with about 32 from Australia, Europe, America, Canada, the UK, a real range of places, really. I had a lot of people submitting their stories, but I did have to narrow it down, which was a really difficult job.
What were the similarities? Well, were there any similarities that you found in these stories?
Almost every teacher that I spoke to as part of the preparations for the book all had one particular thread in common, and that is the fact that they are tenacious, that they can get through and tackle adversity, that they're adaptable, and just that they have this moral purpose, really, that drives them to make a difference.
A moral purpose. Was there also a sense of vocation as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I use that word vocation tenderly a little bit, because there is quite a toxic narrative sometimes around teaching being a vocation rather than a profession, which sometimes mean that teachers never know when to switch off and never know when to create that divide between private and personal and work life. But I think there are certainly elements of being a teacher which are absolutely vocational.
And did you find that there were themes emerge from teachers in different countries?
Absolutely. Again, I think we're all in this game, no matter where you're from, to improve outcomes for young people. That shone through regardless of barriers of where people were educating students.
But were there similarities, say, between teachers in Australia that were different similarities to teachers in Europe?
Yeah, I guess the context that they work in were quite different. Absolutely. I mean, one of the people that I ended up interviewing for the book taught on some of the refugee camps in France. And obviously the challenges and the situations that they encountered on a daily basis were very different from somebody who might work in a private school in Australia.
And what can we learn from this book, do you think?
I think what we can learn is that essentially there's so much more that unites us than separates us, really, as human beings. You know, I don't think this is just a book which is aimed at teachers, actually. I think everybody can identify with some of the stories that they read in the book. And we've all been to school and had possibly negative or positive experiences of teachers. So I think it will resonate with so many.
And was there something surprising that you didn't expect that emerged from what you found?
I just think the sheer differences in and exciting things that teachers have done, really, as backgrounds before they became educators. You know, I've got one science teacher in the book who was part of a best-selling indie group who toured the world. I've got people who've been on reality TV, huge variety of different people, people who were stuntmen in Hollywood. It's just really interesting to look at all of their backgrounds.
And what drove you to be a teacher?
I have got a bit of a bizarre story, really. I was a national newspaper journalist before I was a teacher. I went into teaching by accident, to be honest, wondering what else I could do with an English degree after the newspaper that I was working at was closed down for phone hacking. Yeah, so it was something I fell into, and 15 years later, absolutely adore it. Can't imagine my life having been enriched as much as it has from working with young people.
And was the things that you took away from the stories that will influence how you work?
The kindness, really, and the sheer humanity of people, that even in the worst situations, people manage to persevere. And it certainly puts some of the more trivial things that I might worry about into perspective.
And do you think if there is a silver lining in the pandemic, it's quite hard to find one, but if there is, that suddenly the appreciation of teachers has increased?
Yes, I think we've started to see that. There's still quite a divisive narrative that's peddled by some of the right-wing media about teachers being lazy and schools having been closed during lockdown while we were all sat watching Netflix on full salaries. Anyone who knows teachers or has half a brain cell, to be quite honest, knows that that's absolutely not true. So I do think we are seeing more of an appreciation for teachers now.
And Humans in the Classroom by Hayley Hughes is published by McNidder and Grace. We've been talking on Bookmark today to Annie Domingo about her debut novel, Breaking the Maffa Chain, which is published by Jacaranda. Well, Annie, I was going to ask you what's next, but you sort of alluded to it throughout the interview. A sequel, that's what you're writing at the moment.
Sarah's life was so rich and so much happened to her. I did not want to do her a disservice by trying to put it all in one novel. I wanted to really get into her mind and enjoy this girl growing up. And I thought that it was a good breakup point where she was sent back to Africa. But she did come back. There was always a connection with the Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria sent her books, sent her letters regularly, and she wrote back. So to me, that connection was always there. And then she got married, and Queen Victoria paid for her wedding, and so on and so on.
It's an extraordinary life, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. You know, and it went through the generations because her daughter was also godchild to Queen Victoria, and she was named Victoria. Queen Victoria sent Victoria to Cheltenham Ladies' College and paid for her to go there in the 1860s. Also, part of the reason why I was always interested was because I know the family of Sarah Forbes Bonetta. One of her great-grandsons were close friends of my parents. I'd heard about her, but you don't take any notice. And since then, I've met other family members. And when Sarah's daughter Victoria was christened, Queen Victoria sent a golden christening mug and all of that, which the family still have and I've seen. So for me, that's such a connection.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. There are sequel after sequel after sequel, I think, the whole series. And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark. Annie, what are you reading at the moment?
Oh, I've literally just finished Octavia Butler's Kindred, which is a fascinating book. It sort of goes into the same period that I'm talking about, where they have this woman who keeps disappearing. She'd find herself back in the 1850s. And what happens as she really lived and saw what slavery was like. And she has a connection with this character.
Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. But a heads up that our next show, a kind of a memoirish theme to the next show, our featured guest is Lucy Lewis, talking about her memoir, Lighting the Fuse. It's a memoir on being the UK's first female bomb disposal expert. We'll also hear from Nicholas Royal on his memoir, White Spines, Confessions of a Book Collector. And Sister Gemma Simmons will be talking about her book, Dancing at the Still Point, which is about the benefits of retreats. But we'll sign out now, Annie, with your last choice of music, which is Stand Up by Cynthia Erivo. Why this one? It's a great track. Why this?
Cynthia is a dear friend. She was in The Colour Purple on Broadway. So I'm extremely proud of Cynthia. She's a British girl from Nigerian extraction. So there was a whole lot of hoo-ha when she was chosen to play Harriet Tubman in the film of Harriet Tubman, because they said, why is a British Nigerian girl playing the iconic character? I've always been interested in Harriet Tubman because of the Underground Railroad. I've been to her house in America and I've been to her house in Canada because she lived in Canada for a while. And so I was very enthralled by the film. Cynthia also wrote Stand Up for the film. It's a fantastic song. The music, the words, I've heard several versions of it. I've heard a choir, I've heard a man sing it. It just resounds with me because it just says so much about what we are fighting for or believing in or living through at the moment.
I've been walking with my face turned to the sun. Weight on my shoulders, a bullet in my gun. Oh, I got eyes in the back of my head, just in case I have to run. Can for my people. While the clouds roll back and the stars fill the night, that's when I'm gonna stand up, take my people with me. Together we are going to a brand new home, far across the river. Can you hear freedom calling, calling me to answer? Gonna keep on can feel it in my bones. Early in the morning, before the sun begins, stand up, take my people with me. Together we are going to a brand new home. Far across the river, can you hear freedom calling? Calling me to answer, gonna keep on keeping on. And I know what's around the bend might be hard to face, cause I'm alone and I just might fail, but Lord knows I'll try. Can you?